Hi everyone, different location today. Someone had actually said a few weeks ago I should do one of these next to my coffee machine. I don't know if it's just because they're really into coffee or they see me drinking a lot of coffee. Either way, I've actually got a shorter update today and I've got a quiet house, so I thought I'd do one down here. Now, for those who are wondering, that the coffee, when I do actually tweet a lot of photos of coffee, maybe I'll do one near the beer fridge next time if you want to see me do a beer fridge update, which would be kind of boring because it's in the garage. Anyway, leave a comment. So one of the first things I did when I moved into this house on the Gold Coast away from Sydney, in Sydney we're sort of living near cafes and things like this, so I just walk down and get a coffee. Here we can't really walk to a spot. So one of the first things I did is get a really nice coffee machine. So this is an Expo Bar Minwah 4. And then I've got a Quama grinder just there as well. And what I tend to try and do is context switch a lot. So I will come down here with laptop and everything else and sit next to the coffee machine where I have easy access. And of course, just near the outdoors. This is what winter looks like in Australia. Well, actually, it's what winter looks like in parts of Australia. This is the Gold Coast, which is generally considered to be the sunny part of Australia. On Sunday, I will be driving down to Sydney to do a bunch of talks for the week, and then on the weekend after that, driving to Thredbo, which for those of you not from Australia, is the snow. so that is about a 14-hour drive away from here, but yeah, Australia does have snow for those of you who are wondering. So anyway, yeah, this is kind of the environment that I tend to work in a lot, particularly when it's quiet and there's people out of the house. It kind of gets a little bit too sunny outside to do much of much volume, but I sit here with here's my Lenovo P50 machine here, so the one with the Xeon processor and the 64 gigabytes of RAM and like everything that I need to have a complete mobile work environment. So I often sit here and work on that because I just go crazy sitting in one place the whole time. So anyway, moving on. I mentioned I'm going down to Sydney. I'm not doing any public talks on that part of the trip. I've got a couple of private workshops next week. I'm going to be in Canberra on Friday, speaking to some government people as well. Many of you know the Australian government is using Have I Been Pwned? So I'm going to catch up with some people there, say good day to them. Then I'm going snowboarding for a week. Then I'll be back in Sydney doing some more workshops, one other workshop. And then I'll be doing a talk for, I'm going to make sure I get the name of this right, because sometimes all of these talks do become just a little bit of a blend. So this is for SailPoint. So I will be at the SailPoint conference in Sydney on August 22. So if any of you are around there, that'll be the one public talk I'm doing on this trip as well. And then I'll be back here in the same spot 3 weeks from today. So the next two updates will be from other locations in Australia. And I'll try and do like a nice snow one as well. Show everyone what the snow's like when I'm there. All right, so let me jump into it. So things from this week. Now, one of them, there was a sort of an interesting data breach that I loaded. And this data breach is from a product website called Fashion Nexus. Now, this was a kind of a weird one insofar as the data looks like it belongs to multiple different websites which Fashion Nexus has built, and like a sister website of theirs called White Room Solutions is sort of like the technical arm that did the actual building of it. So it's kind of like multiple sort of links in the chain here. Up to 1.4 million customers. Now there's an interesting story here from Graham Cluley in the UK. Some of you know Graham, he runs the Smashing Security podcast, which I've been on a couple of times. And he wrote this piece up, and there was sort of an interesting argy-bargy, for want of a better term, where the company's going, nah, look, it wasn't that bad. And actually, what they began with, this was a really odd thing. In Graham's article, I'll tell you exactly what they said. Now, Graham does the responsible journo thing. It's like, let's reach out for the company, get comments. He's trying to establish them with them what's actually happened. Now, they have seen the data from the breach. And he's actually screen-capped part of his email here. This is on the 30th of July. He says, this is to someone at White Room Solutions. He says, hi, is there any official statement you are able to offer on the data breach? Their reply, no. And then that's it. Like, it's just no. It's like, we're not saying anything about it. this is not the way to handle a data breach. And I sort of, I'm just trying to find my tweet thread here. I quoted the register. So the register has then picked up this incident. And incidentally, when these things happen, they will get press. And it's going to be one news article picks it up. And if it's got any interesting stuff in it, such as the organization sort of either denying or not providing information or not being seen as being transparent, it gets more press and it snowballs. So pro tip, don't try and cover this stuff up. We find out. So the Register's picked it up, and one of the quotes in the Register was, "The company disputed the enormity of the blunder." And as I've said in the tweet just here, once your data is out there, this is not an advisable strategy. And I think what they're doing is sort of debating whether it was like 1.4 million records or 700,000 records. And it's like, look, guys, the position that you're in at the moment is one where a discussion about just how many records were breached is not really the thing that should be on the top of your mind. Not when it's frankly, a fairly minor difference. Yes, I know it's double, but the point is a heap of your customer data is out there, and what you should be focusing on is trying to actually recover from that incident. So I mentioned that. I also linked to a piece that I wrote, I think this was last year, called The 5 Stages of Data Breach Grief. And this was a little bit like, there's like the stages of grieving when someone dies. And I sort of wrote this, when was this? July 2017, just over a year ago. I wrote this last year when the AA in the UK were denying that credit card data had been deleted. Rather, credit card data had been exposed. And in fact, I've just opened up this blog post. I can see the AA has actually deleted the tweet now, which says, "The AA shop data issue is now fixed. No credit card info was compromised and an independent investigation is underway. We're sorry." And then, in fact, Graham was involved in this one too. And then there's a tweet from Graham and it's like, yeah, here's your credit card data. But, you know, like this 5 stages was, you know, stage one is denial. And eventually you get through to, I think it's about phase 5 is acceptance. So it's like, look, if you've had a breach, you are going to reach the acceptance phase, and you may deny it to begin with, but you will get there in the end, which appears to be where Fashion Nexus may now be. Anyway, so there was that one. There are multiple other incidents I'm still dealing with, still going through disclosures with, which is so freaking painful, but it's the right thing to do. There's another one I may try and get loaded today. I'm gonna see how time goes. All right, so that's that. Now, let me talk about a few other things. A really cool thing, which I don't think I knew was happening, and I say I don't think I knew because I am seeming to have a lot of chats these days with people who say they're going to do things. GitHub is now using pwn passwords. Now, this is super, super cool. So everyone knows who GitHub is. Everyone knows, I just realized my hat is crooked. I've been out playing tennis this morning. And the thing is, as soon as anything is like crooked or not aligned, there's always like half a dozen people who are like, "I watched your video and things didn't line up and I couldn't stop looking at it for the rest of the talk." Too bad. So GitHub obviously has a lot of attacks against it because there's a lot of valuable things in GitHub repositories. They have integrated pwn passwords. They're not integrating with the API, which is fine. There are a lot of other companies that are. There's consistently about 8 to 10 million requests a day to the API. They've downloaded the whole 517 million pwn passwords. And I'm going to read what it actually says when you try to log into GitHub now with a pwn password. It says, and I know this because someone tweeted it to me very soon after. Incidentally, if you're following me and using a bad password, you should know better. Anyway, this person says, this is the screen cap. It says, "Your GitHub password has been reported as compromised in a data breach by Have I Been Pwned? Although passwords may be reused across services, GitHub passwords have not been compromised directly. Please update your password," link to, I assume, the password change page, "as soon as possible. Read our documentation on safer passwords. See our blog for more details." So this is good. And, this sort of fits in. He's actually screen kept this on a mobile app. This fits in a fairly discrete sort of amount of space. So it's a fairly succinct message that links through to more information. I think they've done a really good job of this. I'm really impressed with the way they've done that. And I'm super, super stoked that they're using pwn passwords as well. So that's fantastic. Thanks to GitHub for that. Incidentally as well, and I'm going to check the latest stats now. I'm finding that there's consistently, it used to be like 100,000 unique visitors to Have I Been Pwned a day only a few months ago. It seems lately it's consistently a couple of 100,000 unique visitors or more to Have I Been Pwned each day. One of the things I'm actually most happy about with this is that the only reason I knew that is I looked at the Cloudflare stats, which is actually really good. In fact, on the last day, it was only 160,000. When I checked it yesterday, the day before was like 230, and then the day before that was 215 or something. But I'm really happy that the reason I know that is not because I'm getting alerts about CPU utilization going crazy, but it's because I've explicitly gone and looked at the Cloudflare stats. And a lot of that as well is because I've managed to offload all of that unified search from the Azure App Service into Azure Functions. So the actual app service, the thing that used to get overloaded, is doing a lot less work. And I've still got to move the public API too, so this is going to get a lot better yet. All right, so that was that, the GitHub bit. Now also, whilst I'm speaking about Cloudflare things, one of the things that I thought I'd share last week is a little bit of information about the YNO HTTPS website in terms of Cloudflare caching. Now I'm going to talk about YNO HTTPS more straight after this, but let's talk about the caching thing. I have been talking a lot about how Pwned Passwords manages to do those 8 to 10 million requests a day very, very efficiently and with very, very little load on the Origin website. And a lot of that is due to Cloudflare caching. Now, as I've said many times before, Cloudflare has given me a shinier plan for Pwned Passwords in order to help support that project. So there's almost like a bit of an advantage that I get in terms of what my cost looks like because they're giving me things. And people have sort of pointed that out, which is absolutely fine. They're very, very right about that. But I wanted to make sure that for YNO HTTPS, I just used the absolute free out-of-the-box plan, and I wanted to look at just how efficient we could get the cache hit ratio. So here we go. I tweeted the other day, and I'll link to this tweet later on. When I've written about really high cache hit ratios and Have I Been Pwned courtesy of Cloudflare, some people have suggested it's due to higher level plans. Here's the ynohttps.com site running on the free plan. My cache hit ratio is 99.0% and the cached bandwidth is 99.5%. That's actually a lot better than what I am getting on Pwned Passwords, in part because Pwned Passwords has over a million different cached endpoints, and cache eviction policies mean that sometimes they do get spat back out. This page has got very, very, very few items because there's basically the home page, and then there's one page for each country, so there's 200-something pages in total. And I've got the graphs here as well. So the point I'm trying to make is that you can be super, super efficient. For free. Now, when I shared this, a couple of people said, well, hang on, I'm not getting that. Few caveats here. You've got to return a cache response header from the Origin site on these pages. So Cloudflare and, of course, the clients themselves will honor the cache policy set in that response header. So I've got one there, which I think, I can't remember if it's many hours or if it's a couple of days. Have a look at YNO HTTPS, you'll figure it out. Point is, there's got to be a cache response header there. The other thing is that you want to have a page rule on Cloudflare, and I'm going to tell you exactly what my page rules say, just in case anyone is trying to emulate this. And incidentally, a couple of people who said they weren't getting this, I did see in one particular case Cloudflare chime in, or someone from Cloudflare, and say, here are the page rules to set up, and it looks like it actually improved quite a bit for them. So my page rule, I've got one that my page rule is Actually, let me try this again. I've got one page rule to redirect from www to the naked domain. I've got another page rule which says ynohttps.com/*, so basically everything, cache level, cache everything. So there's two conditions on the, let's actually not say conditions, it's not the right word. There are two settings. One is cache level everything, the other is edge cache TTL a day. So I'm basically saying, look, just max out the cacheability on this thing. So we need to have those page rules in place as well. That's the only stuff I've got on here. And that is getting me that massive cache hit ratio. And this is sort of a really good example of when people say, you know, you shouldn't be using Cloudflare because you could just put a certificate on your own website. Like, it's not just the security things. Things like unburdening all this traffic makes a really, really big difference. And particularly for that bandwidth piece, depending on your underlying architecture and your platform of choice, your hosting platform of choice, that bandwidth cost can be really, really significant. Go to the Azure pricing calculator and start pricing up terabytes worth of bandwidth. That stings. Terabytes worth of bandwidth from Cloudflare on the free plan is free. So many, many, many different reasons why the Cloudflare piece makes sense. Not an endorsed comment as well. I literally went and used the free plan for this. All right, so that's that. Now I want to talk about why no HTTPS, because that is the one blog post I wrote this week. I actually had plans to do other blog posts, but we know what happens to plans. Oh, I've got to talk about Reddit too. I'll talk about that in a moment. All right, so now I wanted to do an update of the data. In fact, I wanted to do an update of the data earlier than what I ultimately did. And the main thing that slowed myself and Scott Helm, of course, down from doing this is getting data that I was happy to put on there. Now, let me caveat what I mean by this. I, as I said with the first edition of this, excuse me, I did not want to have a situation where I was putting data out there which would be perceived to be inaccurate. Now, even as it is in version one, people argued about it. They said, this is wrong or that's wrong. We'll talk about some of those arguments in a moment. But there were cases where I was seeing domains, I was like, look, I'm really sure they shouldn't be there. So Scott did a lot of tweaking to the list which he collects in his Alexa Top 1 Million crawl every night. And there were a couple of significant things that he changed along the way until we got to the point where we had a plan. Now, here's what the plan looks like. He has two lists which he publishes, and they're all on crawler.ninja. Another story as to why he chose Ninja, ask Scott. They're both on crawler.ninja. One is the HTTP list and one is the HTTPS list. So what he does is he takes the million domains and he says, okay, let's get a list of all the ones that redirect via response header. We'll talk about why that's important in a moment. The redirect to HTTPS, they go on the HTTPS list. So there's one list. Let's do another list, which is all the ones that do respond and return content over HTTP, but don't redirect. So now we've got another list. These two lists together roughly add up to about 900,000 of the 1 million domains. The remaining 100,000 are domains which aren't answerable publicly, and I talk about some of those in the list here, or some of those in the blog post. Some of them may return, say, 403. They go, look, no, you can't have access to this. And it might be firewall rules or things like that. Some of them might reject the crawler. Now, even though the crawler attempts to emulate what is a normal browser, there might be circumstances where it gets rejected. So they fall into this 100,000 gap. So what I did is I took that 100,000 gap and I said, okay, I am now going to crawl them myself using my code from my IP address, and then we'll see what happens. And out of that, I think I managed to get about 80% of them I managed to get a response on. And in that list, the ones that did answer over HTTP and didn't redirect, they get added to Scott's list, and now we have an entire list. So it's almost like that there is a second chance for a site that doesn't respond to either end up on the good list or the naughty list. So that was sort of the most equitable way we could find to deal with this. I still need to think about how to automate this fully, but I just wanted to get to the point where we can actually see some updates and actually see reliable data going into there. I don't want to get to the point where I'm automating something and then every day this list is updating and I'm getting people contacting me going, this is wrong, and it's actually wrong. So we will get to automation in due course. Now, a couple of screwy things here. Let's talk about Roblox. Roblox, R-O-B-L-O-X. A number of people contacted me about Roblox and they said, Roblox, maybe because I think it's Robot Locks or something. That website, a number of people contacted me about that website and they said, I checked this, it redirects to HTTPS, you're wrong. Let's talk about the magic of how this redirects. Now, I want to talk about this because it's a really good illustration of why this is a hard problem. And it's also a really good illustration of just how weird and screwy things on the web are. If I curl that address, I get an HTTP 200 back. If someone else goes to that address in their browser, they get redirected to HTTPS. Why is it so? Well, here's what they do. So what I did is I took the response from that web page, it's all HTML, and I've embedded it via a gist here. Now, just to sort of explain it succinctly, what they do is you've requested the page over HTTP, they return the page, they set a cookie in the client, and then they reload the page over HTTP. So there is literally a document.reload called here in the JavaScript of the page. The JavaScript of the page, so here's your first thing, you don't have JavaScript enabled, this is gonna die. So it reloads it, makes another HTTP call, that then responds, if the cookie is present, with an HTTP 301 and redirects you to an HTTPS address. That's just totally screwy. I do not know why you would do that. And as I said, look, it will actually break it if you've got JS. When I say break it, you'll just be stuck on HTTP if you've got JS disabled. Now, to that effect, I've got a section here about is it okay to redirect without a 30X? So for example, a 301 permanent redirect or a 302 temporary redirect. Now, the short answer is it's not okay, but let's talk about why it's not okay because the question has come up multiple times. First of all, there's the whole semantic intent thing. HTTP response headers and response codes do mean something. A 301 means permanently redirected. So the resource that was here is now always here. Was on HTTP, now is always HTTPS. That's important for multiple reasons. One of those reasons is the browser will cache it. So once it has a 301, next time, if you type in an address and it defaults to HTTP, your browser will go, well, hang on a moment. I was told it's permanently redirected. Let us not make the request. Good for performance. Really good for security because the HTTP insecure request is now not sent. The browser just goes, okay, upgrade to HTTPS, job done. So that's really important. Now, an HTTP 302 temporary redirect means, look, we're redirecting for the moment, but this is not a permanent state. The browser won't cache that. Things like crawlers won't update their canonical links to point to the new HTTPS address either. It'll go, well, hang on a moment, this is only temporary. We shouldn't update our indexes. So that's important too. Now, why else is it important? I'm reading through my links here. Okay, it's important for SEO. That's a big thing. Obviously, I mentioned the JavaScript thing. You disable JavaScript, it will break. I've got an example of that in here as well. So that's important. Now, that's a sort of a, you know, it's just basic, right? Like this is where you start. If you want to go HTTPS on all your things, you need to have a 301. Now, one of the other reasons why it's important is that if ever you want to do HSTS preload, which is where we really want to get to with everything, you need to return a redirect from the homepage of the root domain. Because if you go to hstspreload.org and try to preload a website that isn't doing an actual HTTP response status redirect, it's not going to work. So let us now talk about HSTS. And this sort of brings up another issue here, which was related to what, how do I put this? I'm not sure if it's just an entirely a misunderstanding or if it's maybe a chest beating exercise as well. But Whirlpool. So Whirlpool is a very popular Aussie forum, a very sort of tech-centric Aussie forum, been around for ages. It's number 4, I think, on our list of Australian sites that don't do it. It does not do a 301. I'll leave you to read the comments here because frankly, some of them are a bit derogatory, not mine, the founder of Whirlpool. I think it, look, you know how people get on the internet and they bitch and whinge and rant, and then they'd never behave like that in real life because they'd have all sorts of other problems if they did. I think it's one of these cases. So it seems here that they've tried to do part HSTS once you actually authenticate somewhere, but they can't do HSTS consistently and preload it all over the place because they're not redirecting 301 from the root domain. All sorts of other problems. So we want to go down a path of HSTS everywhere by default preloaded. This is our ideal situation. But there is a continuum here about the things you need to do in order to get to the stage where you can do that. And the first part of the continuum is you must 301. Like this is the thing that happens before anything else. Begin with 301, everything else happens after that. So you can read that in the choice of words that someone has decided to use here and amuse yourself with that. Also incidentally, whilst I'm talking about HSTS, For quite some time now, I have had an HSTS header on TroyHunt.com. As people have pointed out over the years, I have not included subdomains and I have not preloaded. Now, all of that I changed the day before yesterday. And I want to explain why it went for so long and then why I changed it. If you want to preload HSTS, one of the prerequisites is you must include subdomains. So when you actually go to hstspreload.org, there's a whole set of descriptions there or set of criteria. One of them is must have include subdomains. As soon as you include subdomains, and you can use include subdomains without preloading as well, but as soon as you do that and a browser sees that response header, the HSTS response header, or you preload and it gets baked into the browser, every single subdomain of your domain will only ever be served over an HTTPS connection. Most of the time, this is fine. The thing that wasn't fine for me is that for the last, I think, 5 years, I have had hackyourselffirst.troyhunt.com as a subdomain which has served the Hack Yourself First website. This is the one from the Hack Yourself First Pluralsight course, and it's the one I use in every single one of my workshops. And the sorts of things I do in there is demonstrate what happens with mixed content. So what happens if we load the page over HTTPS, but we embed something over HTTP? What happens if we load the login page over HTTP, but then we post to HTTPS? So long and the short of it is that I, by design, have needed to serve content over HTTP. Because of that, I couldn't use include subdomains, and because of that, I couldn't use preload, and because of that, people pointed out that there was a certain degree of, a certain degree of hypocrisy with that. And I can't disagree with them, but I am explaining the reasons why. Now, to make it more confusing, hackyourselffirst.com is owned by a domain squatter. Now, putting aside a moment what our feelings are about domain squatters, I thought, okay, well, let's go through the process. So it's being squatted on by someone who's got it parked at GoDaddy. GoDaddy has a domain buy service. So I thought, all right, I don't like domain squatters, but it is what it is. Let's go through and try and buy the domain. Now, I tried to do this, I think, about a month ago. Might have even been June, within recent times. And what you do is you go and you pay GoDaddy some money, and then you give them a range, like I will pay up to this amount for the domain. So I filled in all that, submitted it, paid my money, and that was it. Just never heard anything more. Nothing else happened. No emails, no updated status or anything like that on like the domain buy page. It just sort of said contacting buyer and it just stayed that way forever. And nothing happened. And I keep going back in there and checking it and checking my junk just to see if I missed anything. Nothing. So basically that exercise failed dismally and GoDaddy Domain Service is not a service that I would be recommending. In fairness, someone from GoDaddy did reach out to me later on and explain that, look, there should have been emails. They did actually refund my money as well. So thank you for doing that. That's the right thing. But I do not have much faith in that service. Eventually, I got to the point a couple of days ago where I went, look, this is just like stuff it. This is just screwy. Here's what we'll do. Hack-yourself-first.com. Job done. So the entire Hack Yourself First website is now at that address, hack-yourself-first.com. The old one will actually still bind to the same site, but then there's a message which says, look, it's rolled over to the new address. As soon as I did that and tested it and it worked, I went into my Cloudflare settings for my domain. I set include subdomains on, I set preload on. I went to hstspreload.com, set the site, it's been submitted for preload. In the very near future, troyhunt.com will be built into every single browser as preload. And that will then complete the continuum. 301 from the root domain, include subdomains, obviously the preload attribute, preloaded into browsers. Job done, we are where we want to be on that domain. We can all move on to other things. All right, so that was that. Now look, speaking about other things, I just mentioned Reddit. I think I want to touch on the Reddit situation briefly. So I have commented many times that one of the things that I find fascinating about this industry is that I can wake up one day and like something just crazy out of this world, never expected major has happened. And on the scale of like major crazy things, the Reddit one is not particularly an Ashley Madison, but it is a major thing. Simply because it is a very, very large website. Now, Reddit has said that there was a compromise of what appears to be some staff accounts. We're going to talk about how that happened in a moment. The impact of that was a full database backup from 2007 when Reddit was very, very young. They set encrypted passwords, which of course would mean hashed passwords, which in 2007 probably means MD5, which means basically as good as no hashes. So there was that. There was also the association of usernames to email addresses from, I believe the date was about mid-June this year, so very, very recent. Now that's a lot more alarming, because Reddit is the sort of place where, let's face it, some people behave a little bit like the bloke I mentioned a bit earlier on. You know, like in a way that they wouldn't with their mothers or their family or something like that. Now, that is alarming insofar as many people behave in a way where they would not want it to be associated back to their real identity. And they do so on places like Reddit. We've seen very, very notorious trolls on Reddit. And they are trollish under that username. Now, by design, the email address is not public, except now it is. And apparently it is now if you subscribed to Email Digest. Now, don't quote me on this, but someone said in my Twitter feed, I think by default you are subscribed to Email Digest and you have to unsubscribe or something. I can't remember. It was a long time ago I created my Reddit account. Regardless, there's a lot of people who've had that association between username and email address leaked. What worries me a bit with Reddit is it sounds like those people are not being notified. The 2007 people are, and I've had people confirm that to me, but the ones from very, very recently aren't. And I honestly just cannot imagine why you would not contact them. Reddit has said in their statements, look, you could go into your emails, and if you're getting email digest, then it means you've been in the thing. But surely when it's a data breach and when it is potentially damaging by associating something which is of a personally identifiable nature, which it will be for many people, they won't all be using like throwaway email addresses, when it associates that back to the public identity, that's a real worry. And I'd really, really like to see Reddit do the right thing and actually notify people about that. Talking briefly about how people got their accounts owned. So from what I've read, it sounds like 2FA gone bad insofar as the SMS-based 2FA led to tokens that were sent via the messaging service being intercepted, so possibly SIM hijacking, this sort of thing, and then people getting into the accounts. Now, two things on this. So first of all, we know that SMS has vulnerabilities that the likes of a soft token or particularly a hard token don't have. So ideally, when we are doing any form of 2FA, we want to have a non-SMS-based authentication channel. For example, using Authy, using YubiKeys, using even RSA tokens, things that aren't subject to a telco doing the wrong thing. So that is important, but remember, this is the second factor of authentication. So this is what happens after the other thing as well. So what went wrong with the other thing? So are we talking about the classic case of people reusing passwords, and we've got Reddit employees using bad passwords, being exposed in data breaches, then breaking through the first factor of authentication, then SMS being wrong on the second? So I think there's a question to be asked here as well around what was the situation with the passwords of these people on their Reddit accounts. Now, last thing, because I'm nearly out of time and I've got to run to a meeting. My sponsor this week is Tech Fabric. So they have been around as a sponsor for quite a while now. I'm going to link through to those guys, and I appreciate their ongoing support as well. So just before I run, again, I will come to you next week I'll probably do it from Sydney, maybe. I'm actually not sure when I'm going to be doing it, because I'm going to be driving to Canberra first thing Friday morning from Sydney. So it may even be a little bit late. We'll have to see how it all pans out. But I'll have different stuff to talk about then, and then the week after that will be the snow edition. So thank you very much for watching. I hope this environment worked okay. I do have like the big shiny light down here as well to try and make it work a little bit better. But look, at the very least, it's a different environment, but same old sort of content. Thanks very much for watching, everyone.